So, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for sticking around. I want to echo Brad's sentiments about thanking you for, you're here on the last day, and it's like a ghost town out there. And it's lunchtime, too, so I'm feeling a little pressure to say something really interesting, and I hope I'm going to be able to do that. Yeah, right, an icebreaker or energizer or something. Maybe we've got something out of the choices curriculum to do that, which by the way, as Rebecca said, I've been working around addressing gender issues, particularly in sexual and reproductive health programs, for a long, long time, and developing educational materials and evaluating them. And I recently had a chance to review the Choices curriculum, and I just think the world of it. I think it's some of the most creative work that's being done around gender issues for a key population. We all know that gender norms start being imposed upon young people from the day that you find out if it's going to be a boy or a girl. And somehow we think that it might only be good to start talking about this at age 15, 16, 17. And so I really salute the work that SAVE is doing and NIRH is doing around that, and excited to see how it's progressing. So yeah, as a segue, Marissa was talking about sexual and reproductive health and looking at sort of all levels of adolescence, but a lot of focus was on older adolescents, and Brad was talking about gender norms, and I guess I'll try to bridge these two by reflecting on some work around gender norms, focusing on some older adolescents. These programs are mostly for youth somewhere between the ages of 15 and 24. But really looking at this issue of gender. And what I'm going to talk about today is I'm going to reflect on a setting where there really isn't a whole lot of focus on gender norms. And that is here, not in the Colorado Convention Center necessarily, but in the United States. The fact that if we take a look at some of the most promising and innovative approaches to looking at issues of addressing gender inequalities and looking at constructions of masculinity and femininity, we have very few examples from the United States. And I have some theories about that, and I'm going to share some reflections around that. But really, this session is a bit reflective in that I'm going to be taking a look at what we know about the evidence base of addressing gender norms, and then I'm going to talk about what we know about it in the United States and reflect on some of the work that I've been doing within gender health over just the past year in starting to pilot some programs in different settings in New York, Los Angeles, Austin, Texas, around this work. And I guess the many years leading up to that to sort of even get those programs started. So let me kind of build on some of Brad's comments about this recognition that gender matters, and that particularly it's really important to address social constructions of masculinity. If you think about sort of messages about what it means to be a man, there are many sort of traditional or rigid notions about being manhood that might include being dominant over women, not showing emotion, not being vulnerable, to take risks, to equate sexual conquest with manhood, and that these gender norms we know from various sample surveys from around the world are very much associated with a range of poor health outcomes. That men who ascribe to a more rigid notion of what it means to be male are less likely to seek help, less likely to seek health care, more likely to commit violence against a partner, more likely to engage in substance and alcohol abuse, more likely to have multiple sexual partners, less likely to use condoms, more likely to report STIs. And we find this again and again. In any place where we have a sort of scale that addresses masculinity, we find these things. We found it in Brazil, in India, in Ethiopia. We've even found it in the United States. So it's an important determinant to take a look at. So I think one of the issues becomes, okay, so it's important, right? This is an issue that seems to be associated with these poor health outcomes. But the issue is, what can we do about it? Do we simply just say, well, boys will be boys, men will be men, and that's the way they are, and you really can't change that, right? That's thousands of years of socialization and patriarchy. Or is there actually some way to provide an opportunity to question those norms and create different values and opinions in constructs of masculinity and gender relations between men and women? And that term, that type of work, is called, it's been coined, Brad used the term, gender transformative interventions. This was originally coined by Geeta Rao Gupta, who used to work with the International Center for Research on Women and now works at the Gates Foundation. And she said that these types of interventions do something very different than a lot of other prevention programs, because they actually look at these underlying constructs about what it means to be male and female, and they make very explicit connections between those societal messages and a range of health issues. So if we take a look at some of the characteristics of gender transformative interventions, they often include activities, oftentimes group educational workshops like Brad mentioned in Choices, other programs, that provide a participatory opportunity for sometimes men, sometimes women, sometimes mixed groups, to sort of develop awareness around these gender norms, provide an opportunity, a forum to question them, and to provide an opportunity for them themselves to redefine what it means to be male, what it means to be female. So that, you know, it's not telling you, look, you need to be this way. It's simply asking the question, to be reflective, to say, you know, what are the benefits of this? What are the costs of this? How does that relate? And so that sort of brings me to this next point, that this work explores these vulnerabilities and costs that rigid gender norms create for both men and women. And while I mentioned that there aren't a lot of really good examples of this work in the United States, there is one that I know very well called Men Can Stop Rape and their Men of Strength Clubs. And they have this great question that they ask when they're running their workshops with young men. They always ask, how's that working out for you? Right? So when they talk, when you're having young men who are sort of talking about sort of ascribing to this sort of limited notion about masculinity and how it might be impacting difficulties in their relationship or how they got into a fight or how they got incarcerated, right? It's like, how's that working out for you? How is it like to sort of ascribe to these limited notions about what it means to be a man? How does it impact your relationship with your child? How does it impact your health? So we have to look at sort of what are the costs and the vulnerabilities of this. There's got to be something in it for men, something in it for women to question this and change this. But, you know, workshops aren't the only way to create that social change, and they have a limit. And again, Brad, you mentioned this. I mean, you said that, you know, you're trying to create social change and you're starting to work with these 10 and 14-year-olds. But what are those messages that those young kids get from their parents, from their community, from school teachers, right, from their environment? So we have to think of ways beyond moving around a workshop. A workshop is a great way to start, right? Because you have to have some orientation to this work. So you have to have some personal reflection around this. But what are the messages that you can create in communities through community mobilization, through media campaigns and educational campaigns and different ways that men can actually engage in this action? And even policies that might support men playing a more active role in gender equality. And so that's another piece of this, is to sort of find ways for men to live this, right? To actually be able to articulate this and carry out this work through marches, through community events, through peer education, through engagement in family activities. And then finally, I'm going to talk a lot about men today, but it's really important to recognize that gender norms don't exist in isolation, right? So, you know, men and women create gender norms, right? Men reinforce notions about what it means to be female. Women reinforce notions about what it means to be male. Society creates gender norms. And so to sort of just isolate men and say, oh, we just have to work with men on these gender norms is a false construct, right? Because these are created and gender is relational. So we have to think about ways to sort of work with men and women around this. And I'll share some reflections about how we're doing that in the United States. You know, this brings up a point in both some of our work in Washington Heights, where we've done this, and even some of the work in Brazil. In both cases, where I've been involved in programming, I've had young men who participated in workshops come back to me and say, you know, look, I believe in this, but, you know, my girlfriend is saying, you know, I'm not looking for that guy, right? You know, they're looking for someone else. In fact, the way it was termed in Washington Heights was, I'm not looking for that, I'm looking for a soldier. All right, so it's very important to recognize that, you know, this work is hard. You know, we're talking about years and years of socialization, and, you know, there's several influences, parents, peers, relationships, media that are all influencing this. Okay, so what do we know internationally about the evidence base of this work? In 2007, the World Health Organization did a meta-analysis, a review of 58 programs that work with men and boys. And they wanted to see, you know, what do we know about the effectiveness of these approaches? And in it, They sort of categorized, as WHO likes to do, those green light, yellow light, red light programs. So, you know, based upon some criteria of how rigorous the evaluations were and whether or not they were able to show just attitudinal change or behavioral change, they were able to sort of classify as things that are green light effective, yellow light promising, red light unclear. And what they found is that a little over a third of the interventions were found to be promising, and that a little under a third, 17, were found to be effective. That is, that they were rigorously done and they actually showed changes in gender-related attitudes or attitudes about their men's engagement in sexual and reproductive health or violence or whatever the issue was, and that behaviors were also changed. And what's interesting is that the researchers used this lens of whether or not it's a gender transformative program, and they analyzed those programs that were effective. And they found that actually the majority of the programs that were effective actually used a gender transformative approach, 12 of the 17. And if you looked at the ones that didn't work in a clinic, that sort of just worked around behavior change, communication, and in a community, they found that 11 of the 14 that were effective were using a gender transformative approach, that they were getting at these underlying issues of masculinity. So there's a real case for the need and the evidence base that programs that are gender transformative are more likely to be effective than ones that simply treat men as a target group. So what I'm going to talk about is a little bit about the adaptation of some work that Engender Health and Promundo have done in particularly three settings where we've evaluated the work: Brazil, India, and Ethiopia. And our work in adapting these two manuals in settings in the United States. So these two manuals are, the first one is a sort of amalgamation of Promundo's work with young men in educational workshops, a program called Program H, which H stands for OMENS. And then the other one is our Men's Partners educational curriculum. And what we kind of did is we brought our heads together and we said, okay, let's take a look at sort of the most effective approaches from each of these interventions, and let's put together a resource, a curriculum, on how to engage men around gender equality using this group educational manual. And then the second piece that we put together was a manual that took a look at community mobilization strategies with men and with women, and sort of ways that you can sort of do some of these larger ecological interventions. How can you create a campaign that engages men around gender norms and gender equality? How can you engage men in engaging in the arts to change messages? How can you organize community events? How can you do theater events? How can you sort of work with schools to have activities in the school to reinforce these messages around questioning gender norms and creating new norms of masculinity? So we've used basically one version or another of these materials in three fairly rigorous studies that were included in that WHO review. And these were actually carried out. Do I have a pointer here? I don't know. Here, they were carried out in three places. This is an example of an intervention that was carried out in Brazil, a social marketing campaign about men's use of condoms and equating that with gender equality. Oops. That pointer is not going to work well. This is from India, another intervention where Promundo led, and this was an intervention in Ethiopia where Engender Health and Promundo worked together. In each of these studies, where the principal investigator was Julie Pulowitz from PATH, they used a quasi-experimental design with two intervention arms and then a comparison group. And the two intervention arms, one of them carried out an intervention that was either just the community mobilization or the group educational workshop. And the other one had a combined intervention where you're actually doing both of those approaches, right? So more of an ecological approach. And basically, in all of the intervention arms, young men, after participating in the intervention, were less likely to support inequitable gender norms. So they had a scale, the gender equitable male scale, that was sort of measuring these changes, a validated psychometric scale, and measuring changes in men's gender-related attitudes and determining if they were becoming more gender equitable. So we found that, and also we found that in general, the intervention arms that used the combined intervention were more likely to be effective than just the educational workshop or the community events by themselves. And we also found in those studies some significant changes in behaviors. In Brazil, significant changes in condom use and STI symptoms after both 6 and a 12-month follow-up. In India, changes in condom use and men's reported of sexual harassment and men's violence against a partner after 3 months. And in Ethiopia, a significant reduction of men's reported use of violence after 6 months. So just some illustrative data from these studies. So there's this emerging evidence base from the work of Promundo and Engender Health and other organizations around addressing these issues of gender. The Choices curriculum just showed some of that. So what does this mean for the US? Well, first of all, In the United States, we've actually known for 20 years some pretty compelling data about why it's important to address gender norms. In 1988, yes, that's 1988, right, when we all had very different hairstyles and different fashion decisions, they carried out a national adolescent adolescent survey of males. Joseph Pleck and Freya Sonnenstein did this. It was a national representative survey looking at adolescent males, and in that they had a masculinity scale, and they did some analysis of this that was published back in 1993. And what they found is that young men who held more traditional attitudes towards masculinity were that they had more sexual partners in the last year, they had a less intimate relationship at last intercourse with the current partner, they had a greater belief that relationships between men and women are adversarial, less consistent use of condoms, specific attitudes about condoms that were associated with low condom use. They believed less that male responsibility to prevent teen pregnancy, and they had a greater belief that pregnancy validated masculinity. So this is 20 years ago, right? We had this data. There was no intervention that was developed based on this great study, right? It just kind of sat there, and you know, people said, "Yeah, okay, yeah, that's interesting." You know, if you ascribe to these norms, that may have some serious associations, but there's not much we can do about it. We also have some data around constructions of femininity and gender norms. There was a study in 2003 that found that women whose gender ideology was relatively traditional had a lower age at first motherhood than those whose gender ideology was less traditional, right? And Deborah Tolman's done a lot of work around this issue, and generally one of the findings she found is that the more a girl believes that she should let boys control her relationship sexually, to no surprise, the more likely she is to engage in high-risk behavior that threatens her health, right? So we understand these dynamics and the implications that they have. So my question is, why aren't we doing more about it? Recently, the Office of Adolescent Health identified these sort of tier one evidence-based programs to focus on teen pregnancy prevention and address broader sexual and reproductive health issues. And they identified this long list of over 20 interventions where we have some evidence base that these are effective in preventing pregnancy and reducing sexual risk-taking. Would anyone like to guess how many of these address gender issues? Zero? It's better than that. It's one. It's one. It's a program by Ralph D. Clemente, who's based out of Emory, and it's the CELE program. It was working with young women, young African-American women, and sort of looking at power dynamics in their relationships. And Dr. D. Clemente is now doing an adaptation of that around working with young men. But we don't have a lot of sort of evidence base around this work, and it's really because there hasn't been much out there that's been looking at these gender norms. So a key question for me is, if that's the case, what are we doing about gender in the United States? How is it being addressed? And I'm going to go back to Geeta Rao Gupta's definition of gender transformative and the other types of approaches that she finds within gender work. She offered this continuum. She said that not all programs are created equal in terms of how they address gender issues. And at the bottom of the continuum, or the end of the continuum, you have sort of the worst case scenario, which is to actually do some harm in sort of your messaging around gender, to have a gender exploitative message. That is to oftentimes unknowingly reinforce some harmful notions about what it means to be male or female in order to achieve an end, right? I'm going to show you an example of that in a moment. And then what we find a lot is gender neutral programs that simply just don't look at these gender issues. That simply don't really pay a lot of attention to how, using a condom in a condom negotiation may be different for a man and a woman, or how messages about abstaining from sexual activity may be different based on messages that you receive in being male or female. And then the next level is these gender-sensitive or accommodating programs that at least recognize that men and women are different, so we have to create different programming approaches for them. But that doesn't go to the sort of top level of gender transformative, which looks at these underlying constructions. So let me provide some examples of all of those here in the United States. Let's start with gender exploitative. So this is a program carried out by my very good and respected colleagues at the National Campaign to Prevent Teen Pregnancy and Unintended Pregnancy. So they have a program, it's called Sex Really. It sort of targets early 20-year-olds around pregnancy, unintended pregnancy prevention. And this is a trigger film that they have. And it's a whole scene of sort of these men acting in very misogynistic ways and having a conversation over beer, sharing these really horrible stories about sexual exploits with women. And you hear all these horrible things, and then it goes over to this young woman, and she says, "Oh, I think Phil would be a great father, and I think he'd be a great father to my child." And then it goes back to the scene of the guys, and it has a little arrow, and it says, "This is Phil." And then it comes to this wonderful zinger of a message, which is, you know, guys, are fill in your own expletive, you know, we'll just say dogs for the sanity of this room. Be safe every time, all right? So a gender exploitative message, right? Yeah, their goal is to have women use contraception, right? But reinforcing a harmful notion about what men are. So men see this and they say, yeah, okay, that's the way I'm supposed to be. Yeah, yeah, that's the dominant message of masculinity and I'll adhere to that, all right? And this is not my responsibility. So, you know, certainly we don't want to be doing that. What we find more of is a lot of those interventions that I showed up on the slide are gender neutral. And these are great interventions. I've been trained in reducing the risk. I carried out an intervention of reducing the risk a long time ago when I was a sexuality educator. I love the curriculum. But the curriculum doesn't look at these gender issues. If you take a look at reducing the risk, it really focuses on developing skills around condom negotiation, around negotiation tactics, around delaying skills. It helps people understand how to access clinical services. But there's no analysis of gender in it. And in fact, it's so gender blind that in a way it's good. What they do is they create the characters, and there's a lot of role plays in it. And what they do is oftentimes they have these sort of androgynous names like Lee and Lee. It's the skit between Lee and Lee, and they're negotiating condom use. Well, that's great because, you know, it helps, you know, provide some sense of, regardless of your sexual orientation, this is relevant to you. But what it doesn't do is recognize the power dynamics about what would it mean if Lee, when Lee's male and when Lee's female, and how to negotiate that issue and how that might impact. So I think there's work to be done here in addressing some of those gender issues and a great curriculum like that. Then if you take a look at gender accommodating, a place I know where Brad worked, the Young Men's Clinic, Dr. Bruce Armstrong does a great job in Washington Heights and Columbia University's Young Men's Clinic. You know, where they're providing services for men, you know, they're providing comprehensive sexual and reproductive health services, male-friendly services that are specifically designed for them, but no opportunity to sort of have, while you have those men there, sitting in a waiting room and getting information to sort of critically analyze some of that, some of these messages around masculinity. So finally, gender transformative work. The places where we do find examples of this is, you know, really in the violence prevention field. Again, I mentioned Men Can Stop Rape. This is one of their, you know, I think, brilliant campaigns. It's called the Strength Campaign. The message, the tagline is, "My strength is not for hurting." So when she changed her mind, I stopped. Men can stop rape, right? So they're playing with these constructions of masculinity. Yes, what it means to be a male is to be strong. Let's redefine what that means to be strong, right? It's not for hurting. It's around being respectful for women. Okay, so just a few final conclusions. As I mentioned, we are starting to do work here in the United States, and Gender Health has three projects. One with the New York City Department of Education, where we're integrating Program H into work with ninth grade high school students, looking at ways to integrate that. Right now, and sort of, they have these counselors, they're called SAPIS counselors, they're sort of lay health education providers, and they're sort of bringing young men and women out into educational sessions outside of the classroom. In LA, we're doing work with Planned Parenthood of Los Angeles, carrying out work with men, an adaptation again of Program H and MAP. This is actually an example, sort of bringing groups of men together and having these explorations of masculinity, and particularly how it impacts sexual and reproductive health and violence. And in Austin, we just received, and Gender Health received, a Tier 2 grant from the Office of Adolescent Health to take a look at how gender norms are a key determinant into preventing teenage pregnancy. And so working with the Travis County Summer Youth Employment Program to provide an educational intervention, and then over a year reinforcing those messages through community events and social media. And so that latter one is going to be an evaluation that's going to take place over 5 years, so hopefully we will have some more compelling data. So let me just finish up with a few quick thoughts about what we've learned from the work in the United States. First of all, one of the questions is, oh, well, you can't do this work. That was developed for Africa and in Asia and Latin America. Well, actually, no, it wasn't. Actually, the South African Men's Partners work was really based upon a lot of my work in Austin about 15 years ago, right? So, you know, that argument doesn't really fly with me. And what I've known from the field testing that I've done is that, you know, it's really painful to field test stuff because sometimes you're just trying out activities and they're like, wait, where are you going? We really enjoyed that. Why isn't this going to be a six-week intervention? So, you know, young men really appreciate the space to have these conversations and dialogues, and it is relevant. I think one of the challenges within the United States is the complexity and nuance of constructions of femininity. If you take a look, you know, Rachel Jukes calls the dominant notion of femininity around the world something called acquiescent femininity. That is that you sort of buy into the male patriarchal construct and you sort of defer to men's desires and wishes. Well, the reality in the United States is, particularly in areas with low socioeconomic status, there are a lot of women who in some ways hold a lot more power than men. They're higher educated, they're earning more money, they've developed a sense of independence. And so you'll hear sometimes from guys in some of my workshops, they're saying, the rules have changed, girls are playing us now. And so I don't think we can sort of create this binary that this is the way it is for men and this is the way for women. It's much more complex than that. We need to have that dialogue and that discussion around it. You know, I think, again, that the fact that, you know, most public health practitioners don't see this issue in the United States, it's raised. And I think an interesting indicator of that is when we won our Tier 2 grant, Health and Human Services put up a little abstract of our work. And they didn't promote it as an intervention that was addressing gender norms. We have a social media component. And they're like, wow, this is really interesting. They're using social media to address teen pregnancy. And I'm like, well, yeah, we are. But actually, the core issue, the organizing principle of the intervention is actually gender. So even our donor is having a hard time understanding that. You know, I think another challenge with the work is that, you know, gender is this gateway factor that addresses so many issues: fatherhood, teen pregnancy, STIs, violence. And yet, you know, particularly in the United States, we seem to operate under these silos. APH works that right? You know, there's no sort of inner dialogue. So, you know, we're doing a teen pregnancy prevention intervention. We're not talking about STIs. We're not talking about fatherhood. We're not talking about violence. But gender is related to all those things, and you'll have positive outcomes around all those issues. Finally, I mentioned reducing the risk. I think there are opportunities to integrate this gender work into existing curricula. Even the CECAS guidelines say that comprehensive sexuality education should address gender. So I think, you know, sometimes it's not about creating a new program, it's just putting a little gender analysis in there. And obviously the United States has great media opportunities, there's great resources, and, you know, working in schools is tough. And finally, I guess I'd make my final case to just think about, you know, not this work just being work with men. You know, we've evaluated work that specifically addresses men, but given that gender is relational, I think programs like Choices, I think programs like we're doing in the United States, where you're bringing men and women together to have a discussion around these issues, is quite critical. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. That's fascinating, Andrew. Do we have any questions? Yes, please.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder internationally if that comes up at all.
Yeah, it does. And it's a very it's a very difficult. Do you want to take a crack at it, Brad, or you want me to? Go ahead, you take it first.
It's very hard to deal with. I mean, you look at what's going on, if you're tracking in Uganda right now. Has everyone seen that in the papers? They printed pictures of 100 gay and lesbians of Uganda and wrote "hang them" on it. And there's still huge anti-homosexual movements in these countries. That's an extreme example, but it's what I find sometimes is when you put it in there, the community doesn't even want to go into the rest of your work.
Yeah.
And that's the part where you need a lot of work that needs to be done around there.
It's a real challenge. You know, I think I've been rightly accused sometimes of some of our programs being heteronormative. Right, so, you know, that you sort of, you know, the work you're talking about is typically, you know, men and women and their interaction together. And it is because I think it is such a challenge to raise this issue. I do make the case, though, that for me, really the only way to address homophobia is to deconstruct this sort of hegemonic model of masculinity, right? That in order, you know, the way to sort of, you know, become accepting of men who are of a different sexual orientation is to recognize that there are masculinities, right? There's many ways to be a man, and that, you know, that your sexual orientation does not, preclude you from being a man, that in fact it is one way of being a man, and that sort of, you know, breaking out of that limited notion about what it means to be male. So I think that's an important exercise to do. That's a very hard exercise to do in a place where gays are being, threatened to be killed, prosecuted, jailed, imprisoned. So it's a process. In South Africa, where we had our first MAP program, you know, there was a real interest from our educators in wanting to address homophobia and sexual orientation more, but it came from a point of them saying, you know, in doing this work and promoting gender equality, all my peers are saying that I'm gay. And so that was sort of the entry point. But it was an entry point. You know, as an entry point to say, okay, well, let's talk about sexual orientation. What does that mean? Let's talk about, you know, the tenets of this work, and we're working from a gender and human rights perspective, and therefore we need to, you know, address that. But it's hard.
And there are groups. There are more local level groups. I remember my Save the Children Youth colleagues in Sweden were working with a group called GALS in Zimbabwe, Gay and Lesbian Association of Zimbabwe. The policy environment there, they weren't even allowed to register as an official NGO. But they're allowed to be an association. Then there's the whole laws around what they can do and can't do.
So sexual orientation, one thing. But I'm thinking about gender identity. And yeah. Your transgender or your body and your internal sense of identity don't match. Mm-hmm. That comes up when you're just talking about male and female.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it does for me. Go ahead. Yeah.
And as well as sexual orientation, and it is difficult. There are a lot of places where we work and where we all work that there's very little acceptance about it. But I think when you take the human rights standpoint, you can say, well, you may not understand it, but everyone, you know, but here are the rights that people have, and people can get to the point where they agree that no one should be discriminated against. You know, so that's sort of the initial goal point. If you can't really get people to where they understand these very, you know, complicated ideas around, you know, a gender continuum or different expressions of gender.
Yeah, and the way in our Men as Partners curriculum we address it, in that there is an opportunity because you're talking about gender and you're differentiating sex from gender, and it's important to talk about biological sex, gender identity, right, how you feel about that biological sex, you know, gender roles, the messages about being that biological sex, and then sexual orientation, right, the sex that you're attracted to, and to sort of break that down. And that becomes easier if you're just deconstructing gender roles. So there are opportunities to do it. It's not that there's not a whole lot of homophobia attached to it in the conversation. Yeah.
Any other questions? Yes, we have a question there.
So there's kind of this great work in Thailand on transgender work and power as a meat and NGO that's really been addressing that issue. But I had a question for you, Andrew, about working in cross-cultural situations and how masculinities can be defined so differently in different cultures, and how you see that in your work being both working in South Africa and also working in New York or Texas, which also has different cultural definitions of masculinities, and kind of how you're able to wrestle with that, how those interventions can be defined upon the differences of those cultures and
masculinity. Yeah. No, I mean, absolutely. Like, masculinity, you know, is seen through this lens of race and class and socioeconomic status and culture, and that has to be recognized. And I think the only way that can really be done is to sort of you know, explore that in a very participatory way, right? To have, you know, to give people voice to explain, you know, what does masculinity mean to me? What are the messages that I've received as a young Latino growing up in Austin, Texas, or, you know, an African-American man living in Harlem, right? Or being, you know, a 14-year-old boy in Nepal. And it's interesting that, you know, so there are those dynamics that certainly play into it. And, you know, an example I mentioned was sort of how gender roles play out very differently in a place like Washington Heights, where we find that women are having, you know, in some ways, a relative more power than men, right? So that's an example of how gender roles might play out there. But, you know, I think that, you know, that dialogue, that opportunity for people to express that is the way it can be done. And I think the other thing I'd say is, while there are these different variations in masculinities and way that people experience their gender roles and their way of being male or female, I'd also say that in a lot of these activities, if you took a look at the list of messages around what it means to be male from, you know, the, you know, Nawalparasi and the Terai in Nepal or in Washington Heights or in Thailand or in Brazil, I mean, it's amazing how similar, so that dominant message, that dominant story about what it means to be a man is. So it's both, right? It's weird that it would be like so similar yet so different, but it is.
Do you have any other questions for Andrew or Marissa or Brad? Question?
Okay. I was wondering if you use any protective mechanisms in the culture that you're working in for some of these messages trying to get out. For example, we work in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. we work with male health providers mm-hmm. on family planning and reproductive health. We work with them directly, and when we started this program, it was not the most popular program at the beginning, but 3 years into it, it's expanding. One of the things that we have used in our program is to focus on what works in that culture, yeah. in this male-dominant society,
yeah.
and pick on protective mechanisms that exist in all cultures,
yeah.
and try and incorporate that into our strategy. So I'm wondering yeah. if there are areas where you see that could be utilized.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think you have to, and I think that does speak to, you know, the cultural specificity of the work. I think there are challenges in that, and the question that was presented to Brad was, I think, a very poignant one, right? About the risk is, as you sort of, you know, work in male-dominated societies, and you sort of try to build on positive aspects about what it means to be a male, are you also, in some ways, reinforcing some of those negative, harmful, dominant examples. And I'll give you a very clear example. Johns Hopkins did a really interesting project in Zimbabwe many years ago around men and family planning. And the message that they created was family planning, it's your choice, and it was targeted around men. And you think about it's your choice, that sounds like a generic message around family planning. Well, the way that men interpreted the message was that, you know, they thought, yeah, it's my choice, it's not my partner's choice, I'm the decider, I'm the head of the household, I should make the decision. And they found that shared decision making around family planning actually went down after the intervention. So, you know, I'm all for recognizing, you know, traditional religious beliefs and different traditional cultural beliefs that that talk about the role of a man in his family and in reproductive health. But I think we also have to constantly monitor, how does that get interpreted? And, you know, how can those messages also support egalitarianism and some of the human rights that we're trying to support?
Just to back on that, but there's been a few things written about sort of promoting health protective norms and sort of questioning the norms that contribute to poor health outcomes. So when you're looking at work in different cultures, that you're promoting cultural norms that are helping to protect cultural norms that promote good health, but then questioning the ones that are, mm-hmm. you know, like FGM and things like that, or
right.
to the most extreme. But,
right.
But
so deconstructing that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I was just going to add to that how when you're working with 10 to 14-year-olds and younger than 10, child protection is a serious issue. We thought about it a lot. We were quite nervous in the beginning. We didn't want, they're impressionable. We didn't want to lecture them and say, go do these chores, boys, you all need to help out. And then they go and do them and dad beats them, or hits them, or even yells at them, get out of the kitchen, you whatever, what are you doing here? And because then there could be emotional issues as well. So we really thought about this, we were concerned about it. And I think that's why we had to limit our expectations, talk to children and find out what could they actually change if they were to do it without getting in trouble, without getting hurt, and hear from them. And now we can build upon that as we go out on this ecological model. We move from the child to their families and then to the community, which is part of our next stage and our next plan. So it is, when you're working with younger kids, it's definitely child protection is a concern.
Well, any other burning questions? Okay, let's take one last question.
Yeah. I also struggle with that issue a lot in terms of just not just reinforcing, you know, the man as I'm doing this to protect my family. Mm-hmm. I feel like that creates another box that's just as restrictive mm-hmm. as, you know, the man as a protector.
I can take a minute and one example.
Yeah.
One of the things that is going on right now in Afghanistan is the security issue. Mm-hmm. The last couple of years, the security has deteriorated and it's very difficult for our trainees to come to the training standards and back and forth. So one of the things that we point out, and we ask them to talk to the male patients about, is that men in this society are mobile. They're able to go from mm-hmm. point A to point B. Where women, for a number of reasons, security being one, you could say, are not. So as a man who's able to get around, if a man was to go to the clinic and pick up the oral contraceptive, yeah. pick up the condom, then that's something that a man can participate in, whereas a woman would have to stay home for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. So there's several different things, and it's not all about the protection, mm-hmm. because if you emphasize that, which is if you keep saying that you're the man and you're the decision maker, you know, you have to keep that balance, because you're always mm-hmm. trying to propel women. But there are things that go on in society that you can use to
using privilege to promote equality.
Yes, because this is, and they can't argue with it. I mean, they agree with it, and that's the fact. That's what's going on right now, and it makes sense.
Yeah. No, that's okay, a great example.
Okay. Well, I'd just like to thank all of you for coming, and I hope you enjoyed the session as much as I did, and safe travels home.
Thanks.